Hi, I'm Monica Hallan, and this is my podcast, Let's Talk Money. Every Friday, a new episode will drop that gives you a snapshot analysis of one money-related topic that has meaning in your life. And then I answer your money questions. My hope is to put you on the path to financial stability and freedom. So, let's talk money. Today, we are going to talk about this complicated thing called rupee and its value. Each time you go abroad and you pay for something in dollars, you realize that your rupee is buying lesser and lesser dollars, isn't it? Whole stack of rupees and a few dollars. Why do currencies change value and what determines this? So I'm going to do a quick lesson in history. You know, money used to be backed by a commodity like gold, where one unit of the currency could be exchanged for one unit of gold. And that was a long time ago. But the world gave up what is called the gold standard in 1971. And then what took over was paper currency. It's called fiat currency, and this is backed by the government. Okay, it has no intrinsic value. It's just paper, and now it's bits and bytes on a computer. It derives its value from the strength of the government and the economy that backs it. It is the credit worthiness of the government, which means how able is this government to pay its debt? You might notice that currency of leading powers of the world are the strongest, and we call them hard currencies because you can take it almost anywhere in the world and transact with that. And you might even notice that as the world power axis shifted from UK to US, the dominant currency of the world changed from the pound sterling to the US dollar. The world is in transition again, but we don't know where the dollar power is moving to. We are still in this phase of figuring out what happens, which is the next hard currency. For today, it is the dollar, and it looks as if it's going to retain the crown for a long time. But let's talk about the rupee. You know, our rupee's value is seen in relation to a basket of currencies, but the most common comparison is with the dollar. And honestly, if you're just transacting in India, the value of the rupee means nothing to you. It's only when either you travel abroad, you study abroad, or you are importing and exporting that suddenly this value of the rupee makes a difference to you. So what affects this currency? Why does this go up and down? It's a complicated story, but I'll try and drill it down into four main things which affect the value of a currency. But at a very basic level, you look at it as demand and supply. We know basic rules of economics. Demand goes up, supply remains the same, price increases. We apply the same thing in terms of currencies. When the demand for a certain currency goes up, its value goes up. And the reverse is also true. Many other factors which actually then affect this demand and supply. The first is inflation. Now, you have to do a little bit of a mind imagining game and imagine there are two countries, A and B. A has inflation of 2% and B has inflation of 10%. And imagine everything is fine, the world is open, people can transact seamlessly across geographies. Because A has lower inflation, which means prices are rising slower than in B, country B, B's citizens will want to buy from A, isn't it? They will try and make their purchases in a country where prices are going up slower than their own. Therefore, countries with low inflation, for example, the US till recently, has seen a strengthening of their currency because B will be forced to buy A's currency to be able to transact in that country. Demand for that currency goes up. So that's entry-level explanation of currency values rising. Second is interest rate. Now you ignore inflation for a moment. A has interest rates of 5%, you know, the interest you get on your fixed deposits in banks. B has an interest rate of 9%. A has 5, B has 9. Then money will flow from A to B because the deposit rates are higher. You would want a higher return on your deposit, so therefore B's currency should go up. That value should go up, except now you look at what inflation does. We know that the impact of inflation is to reduce purchasing power. It reduces the value of the currency. So A with inflation of 2% an interest rate of 5 is giving what is called a real return of 3. This 3% is ahead of inflation. And B gives a negative return of 1%. So if inflation rates are taken into account, we see that A's currency is still gaining value simply because the real interest rate there is higher. The third factor is capital flows. Again, there are countries, they are buying goods and services. When you have inflows into investments into a particular country, whether it's in setting up a business or it's going into stocks and bonds, the savers of a country are putting their money into the second country, causing that currency, which is the destination, to strengthen because they are buying more of the local currency to buy up assets there. So if you might have noticed, India tries to make foreign investment attractive. It gives tax breaks. NRIs get tax breaks and a higher interest rate on some of their deposit accounts. That is the Indian government's attempt to try and get foreign currencies to come and buy assets here. Fourth is a current account deficit. Now, these are all jargon words, but essentially, it's the plus and minus of trade. If B buys more from A, it is said to have a deficit on its current account. Then B will need more of A's currency to buy its goods. And that pushes up the value of country A's currency. In fact, current account deficit is one of the key areas which is watched very carefully when we are looking at the value of currency. Currency markets are a very complex mesh of internal, external, geopolitical issues. But you know what? Counterintuitively, some of the countries don't want a strong currency because it's not good for exporters. Understand that as an importer, a strong currency is good because you're able to buy more. But for an exporter, it's not that good. So countries deliberately try and devalue their currency so that their exports have an edge over others in the international markets. In fact, China and US have been at loggerheads in the past when the US has accused China of deliberately devaluing its currency to make its exports more competitive. Why has the Indian rupee been depreciating? You know, at an average since independence, we have seen the value of the rupee against the dollar fall from 4 rupees 16 paisa, 1947, to today it's around 83, 84. When you look at an average annual rate of increase or decrease in this case, it's only a 4% decline that we've seen over time. And you have to understand, it's a country which has weak fundamentals, high inflation, high current account deficit. It will see a depreciation of its currency. The Indian economy has been battered by all of these ills. Inflation, current account deficit, fiscal deficit, which is the government borrows too much money, which then causes inflation. So we have had periods of very high inflation, but what you also need to understand is that an orderly depreciation of the currency is not dangerous because it actually helps the exports of a country do well globally. But if it happens suddenly, if it is a speculative run like what we saw during the Asian crisis of 1997, then it is devastating to the finances and stability of a country. So next time you travel abroad, check on the value of the rupee, and now you know why it is going up and down. It could be because the country has got high inflation or current account deficits or a macroeconomic instability. Or it could just be that the central bank and the government together are doing a controlled devaluation so that the exports are doing better. So, you know, this posturing that people do that, oh, rupee is declining and India is getting weak, may not be true. You need to worry if you see a large fluctuation in the value of the rupee. What happens in the future? It really depends on how India does, strength of our economy, if we are able to keep inflation under control. So next time you buy dollars, I'm sure you're better in control of knowing why the value is up or down. Okay, now on to questions. May has the bag open with questions spilling out. Bring them on, and we are talking retirement today.
Hey, Monica. So I have a question from Pihu from Delhi, who says, I am 23 and I think retirement seems really far, far away. and I don't really see the need to plan for it right now. I mean, who plans for retirement in their 20s? It's more likely for my father to retire than me. I don't see the point, and I'd rather support myself now with whatever I have and save for an emergency rather than plan for retirement, which I can start doing later in life. How should I think about retirement when it seems like such a distant future?
Right, Pihu from Delhi, this is a question which is existential, especially at 23, where people like your dad retire, and this is something which never happens to you. And also, it's a lot about living the life today versus actually planning for a very, very distant future. And I understand the concern that at 23, you have very little resources to actually save. You're just beginning to earn. The surpluses are very thin. And my advice to people of your age always is that what you need to do is get into the habit of saving rather than trying to save very large amounts. And also understand that although it seems far away, the entire drama of earning is a 25 to 30 year story in which you start to work, you create a surplus, and a part of that surplus goes towards sustaining you towards the last part of your life, which today is about 25 to 35 years because of the way that people are living longer and longer. I find people your age always think that you will make your millions through a startup, or you will make a wonderful investment which is going to give you that supernormal return. You know, a startup is actually a very viable way to build millions quickly. But don't you think you should have a plan B working silently in the background? And that wonderful investment really happens to other people. I've rarely come across a person who has not only made the money, but also kept it. There are various skills involved here. Let's assume that you do make your money, but you do need the skill to make it work for you long term. We know that more than half the people who win a lottery, they lose it within the next few years and they go bankrupt. So this is not to scare you. This is all just to tell you that have a plan in place. Retirement does seem very far off. And my advice to a lot of you is to download an aging app and look at your own face at 40, 50, 60, 70, 80. Because look, you will get there. Some of the stories I hear from the people at your age cohort is that climate change will end the world, or, you know, we will just nuke ourselves. If that does happen, then we are all gone. It doesn't matter whether or not you have it. But all these thousands and thousands of years, we've managed to survive as a human race. We probably will. So therefore, I think you do need to have a plan where you're looking at the next 25 to 30 years of your life to live today, of course, but also get into the habit of saving something for the future. So I'm not saying that compromise on your entire lifestyle today, but could you put away 5% of your take home? Is that too much to ask? And put it away in a long-term product like, say, an index fund on the Sensex or Nifty 50. I don't think getting into the habit of just saving 5% for a long-term goal is that difficult. What you probably are afraid of is advice which says that don't live today and only save for tomorrow. I don't agree with that. I think your 20s decade will only last that one decade. It never comes back. So it's extremely important to do well today. But just getting into the habit is a great idea. Pihu from Delhi, I wish you a youthful attitude in your entire life, but I cannot promise you eternal youth.
This one comes in from Sikkar from Ranchi, who's asking, how much is enough as a retirement kitty? I'm 32 and I don't know how much I need to target to live comfortably post age 60. I do plan to keep working even past 60, but I want to have the choice to work or not.
Sikkar from Ranchi, do you know that you've put your finger on one of the toughest questions to answer in economics and finance? There is a Nobel Prize winning economist called William Sharp, and he has called it the nastiest and the hardest problem to solve. And what is that problem? How to have enough today and save enough for the rest of your life. Because there are two kinds of uncertainties which are almost impossible to put a number to: the value of your investments in the future and the uncertainty of how long you will live. You build in things like inflation, world wars, oil price shocks, pandemics like the COVID, and you build in the uncertainty of your life, whether it ends now or you live till 100. Literally, this is an answer nobody can give. So you have to understand that we can only make an approximation and make plenty of assumptions. A golden rule that I follow is I overestimate life, how long somebody lives. I will underestimate returns so that we are conservative what we are thinking of in the future. And we overestimate inflation. And then we work out the numbers, because I would rather leave money to my heirs than run out of money. So I've crunched some numbers using some of these assumptions, very conservative assumptions. It'll actually have you plus rather than minus. This is a little complicated process, Seeker, so take this down. You have to project what you will be spending in the last year of your working life. And typically, we should say age 60. I know you plan to work till after that, but it's a function of getting the work, being still relevant in the future, skill sets, technology, all of that. So whatever you are spending today, it's not about income, it's about spending. Inflate that using 5% inflation metric. There are calculators online that will help you to do that. So you're projecting your annual expense to the future and you're getting a number at age 60. Now you need a multiple of this, because that's the corpus of which you will invest that in a mix of bonds, fixed deposits, equity funds. And then you use a laddering approach, which is that you keep the money you need for 10 years in a safe debt portfolio or fixed deposit. And the rest of it, you put in an equity fund for growth. And every 10 years, what you do is you redeem that equity because it's grown and fund your safe so that you can eat for the next 10 years. So we call it a laddering approach. So you've got a number for your 60th year annual spend. Now you need a multiplier. What is the multiple which is going to keep you well funded in your retirement? There are three options ahead of you. So the way that a lot of financial planners in the US work is that they assume that you will eat up your corpus, right? So there's a corpus built. Let's say it's 10 crore. They will assume a rate of withdrawing from this corpus so that at age 100, the value goes to zero. So if that is the approach you follow, you need 18 times of your 60th year spend. I don't think we in India think like that. We are risk averse and we also want to leave legacies for our kids. So if you plan to leave the entire corpus for your kids and just eat off the return, then you need 35 times of your spend at age 60. I typically work with a middle number that you eat into the capital about half and half you leave. So that comes to 26 times of your annual spend. So if you're spending 30 lakh at age 60, your target corpus is 8 crore. All right, so that is the way you will have to sit with calculators and do your own maths. And you should know that it's an approximation. Like you said, you plan to continue working post 60. That's a great idea, because current rupees always reduce the need to liquidate your portfolio. So that's a good idea to do. I have another income-related thumb rule to give you. So you're 32, you said. Now by age 40, you should have 3 times of your annual income. Okay, annual income is something we know, and that's not too hard to project what you would have at age 40. So at age 40, for your retirement, you should have 3 times of your annual income. By age 50, you should have 6 times of your annual income. By age 60, you should have 8 times of your annual income, right? These numbers look very big. But you know, Seeker, I have found if you consolidate your assets, you'll discover that you have much more than you think. Include your provident fund, your tax saving investments that you have done, and all of the other assets, real estate, any policies that you might have. And then you can come to the incremental savings you'll need each year. So Seeker, you're setting out on a difficult journey, but you're starting early. And that gives you an extremely long runway to prepare your finances to outlast your life.
All the way from Coimbatore, we have Abhi, who says, I'm 34, single, and I plan to remain that way. I will have only myself to look after in my old age, and I might move to a retirement community when I turn 60. I am clear that I want to focus on my career and not get into the whole home, kids, husband drama. Given these details, how much should I be putting away for retirement? Since I have no kids, I have no goals of creating a corpus that somebody will inherit. Whatever's left, I plan to just donate to my faith-based organization.
Such amazing clarity. I love it. Absolutely the right kind of question that I want to answer. But because you have no dependents and you're so clear on what the rest of your life looks like, we need to clear some issues. The first thing is that you need to throw out any life insurance policy that you might have. Remember, a life insurance policy is bought to protect the people who depend on you for income support. Your profile has no need for any life insurance, so a lot of people are sold policies by agents, by banks. If you have them, my suggestion will be to close them, get rid of them. Don't buy any term insurance, you don't need it. What you need is a very good medical insurance policy in place. Normally, if there is a spouse and there is a family, there is some support in terms of ill health. Choose carefully so that you have a policy you can renew lifelong, because you have to be self-sufficient in case of medical emergencies and not dip into your savings. Third, you need to prepare your emergency fund. 6 months of monthly expenses, whatever you spend in the month, times six at least, if not 8 or 12, is what you need to keep in a secure product like a fixed deposit, or if you understand debt funds, in a debt fund. You make that corpus, you put it away, because again, being single, you don't have a backup of a partner. For your retirement, because you have no dependents, you can target 18 times of your annual spend at age 60. I have just spoken about the multiples that you need in the previous question. You can draw down your portfolio so that by age 100, there's almost nothing left, simply because there is no child to inherit it. How much you need to save is a function of how much you already have. I don't have this information, but there are plenty of retirement calculators online which will help you with this. Market regulator is SEBI, Security and Exchange Board of India. They have an investor education website, investor.sebi.gov.in. They have put some very good calculators on, because remember, you need to get your numbers crunched by a trusted source, and who better than the market regulator? So look at this site, look for the calculators where you can put in your current assets and it'll spit out the number that you need to save every month. Extremely important, you need to put what happens to the rest of the estate, whatever it is that you have when you are not there. You need to have a will. You need to have either a trusted lawyer, a trusted relative, or a financial planner, so that your desire to leave whatever is left to your faith-based organization is honored. It may be a good idea to inform somebody in that organization so they know that when the time comes for you to go, there is that asset which is coming that way. So, complicated set of suggestions for you, Abhi from Coimbatore, but you do seem to have a clear direction in your life. And it's always good for me to see a very money-sorted person.
And that's a wrap for today. I enjoy answering your money questions. Remember, I don't look at individual portfolios. I don't recommend products. Look upon this space as a place to ask strategy questions, doubts, and just basic things that you might not understand. Each time you have a good money outcome, I feel that I have won. To make sure that you don't miss an episode, press follow and help your friends get money smart by sharing a link with them. You can reach out to me at mailme@monicahullan.com. That's Monica with a K. Tag my social media handles @MonicaHullan. And finally, remember that you should have money and money should not have you. So let's talk money again soon. Bye.
Let's Talk Money is hosted by Monica Hullan. This is a Made in India production. Creative Director, May Mariam Thomas. Project Manager, Sean Phantom. Head of Audio Production, Karthik Kulkarni. Producer, Meghna Gulati. Sound Editor, Sarthak Ray. Artwork Design by Alika Gupta.